Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, whose life matters? It's a question that staff writer and author Evan Osnos asks in his newest book titled Wildland, The Making of America's Fury. His deep research inside three very different communities, Greenwich, Connecticut, Clarksburg, West Virginia, and Chicago, Illinois, shed new light on why America has become such a divided nation. He details the sources of our disconnectedness between 9/11 and the January 6th insurrection. Evan Osnos joins me to talk about why deep tensions between individual freedoms and the common good are roiling our nation and what could lead to change. Evan, you say that in the weeks and days leading up to Biden's inauguration, democracy in America had come closer to failure than many Americans had ever imagined. Tell me what you saw going on in those days and weeks.
There was, in a sense, these little moments of awareness where we would discover that there had been a crucial intervention by somebody as sort of seemingly minor in the grand scheme of things as the Secretary of State of Georgia. So we remember we would get news that the President of the United States had called this official and had said, steer the results in one direction or another for my benefit. And what was kind of amazing to realize was how much this was not a matter that was being litigated on the highest levels at the most formidable levels of government. This was resting on the shoulders of individual people. People, for instance, in Detroit who were counting votes despite the fact that there were protesters outside who were intimidating them, or in other cities where this was happening. And I was struck by that. This idea that a system which is, after all, rooted in our belief in institutional heft was actually was hanging in the balance because of some and was being preserved, really, not to be too melodramatic about it, because of the actions of a few brave individuals.
But, you know, it really is dramatic when you think about the change from what America was or seemed to be 9/11/01,
yeah,
and January 6, 2021. What was happening to create this massive change in how we see our country now?
I think that a few important streams coalesced into a moment of political transformation. One of them, I think, was the specific experience of 9/11, which is to say that it was such a rare moment of American sensation of vulnerability, the idea of being hit by surprise, hit on home soil, and of course hit in such dramatic fashion. It was a kind of shock to the psyche, I think. And one of the things that's really interesting is if you look historically at the way Americans have responded to acts of terrorism, it tends to be that fear is elevated for about 18 months and then it goes back to normal. Surveys show that. After 9/11, that didn't happen. It stayed elevated for years, in fact. A decade and a half later, we were still operating in this state of kind of collective anxiety. And that didn't happen by immaculate conception. What I'm really struck by is I go back and research the way that our politics proceeded was that there were people who, let's be blunt about it, were opportunistic about taking that moment and for their own either personal advancement in politics or because they saw it as a gateway to issues that they wanted to advance, began to push the American system further and further down this track of suspicion, xenophobia, and ultimately a skepticism about the very nature of truth itself. And I'll give you just one example that really strikes me. There's a name of a congressman who's sort of lost to history, and he, in its own strange way, is important. A guy named Tom Tancredo, who was a congressman from Colorado, you'll remember. And what's interesting about him was he made this move in politics where he started talking about fear of terrorism, fear of Islam, fear of people coming from abroad. This was starting in the years after 9/11. And over time, he began to merge that into this much larger miasma of fear about immigration and about people coming into the country at all. He'd introduced a bill in Congress called the Jihad Prevention Act, which said that anybody who was an immigrant to this country had to renounce any claim to wanting to install Sharia law in the United States. It was a delusion. I mean, this notion that we were suddenly beset by this kind of risk was a way of creating a sort of seedbed for these ideas, which later became dominant. And one of the things that's remarkable when you go back and you look at the world that Donald Trump presided over politically, he had taken elements that were already in play in politics and he assembled them and boiled them down to their most effective form.
But, you know, before Donald Trump came along, there was George W. Bush's decision to invade Iraq and the, quote, presence of material to create disaster in Iraq that then Secretary of State Colin Powell went to the UN and talked about. That in and of itself created a really wide difference in opinion among leaders, among politicians, among the ordinary individual. How much did Iraq contribute to our divisions?
Hugely, because it eroded Americans' trust in the information coming from government. And, you know, in a way, I think, Diane, you have to put it in league with Watergate as a moment of transformation in our perception of our leadership and what we can trust. And when you look at it over time, you see there are these stair-step moments when Americans have lost confidence and credibility, have lost confidence in what their leaders are telling them. And Iraq, I have to say, extended that pattern of skepticism to my own industry. I mean, the media also was damaged as a result of the decision to invade Iraq. And I think for both legitimate reasons and then ultimately for opportunistic reasons, I think in multiple ways, there were people who said, you can never trust what the media is telling you because look what they did in Iraq. And I think that's a powerful piece of that legacy.
You had been out of the country reporting for a number of years before 9/11. And I'm so interested that as you wrote this book, you decided to focus on three areas of the country: a town in West Virginia, Chicago, Illinois, and what was the third?
Greenwich, Connecticut.
And why?
Greenwich is the place I grew up. And it is a wealthy town outside of New York City. And in some ways, it is the engine room of American capitalism. I mean, this goes back more than 100 years. It has been a place first during the Industrial Revolution, and then in the present moment, in what we might eventually come to call the financial revolution, I suppose, is this period in which financialization of the economy has been a defining fact of the American economic experience. And Greenwich is important to that. It's funny. It's just a town of 60,000 people, but it is a place that has traditionally attracted some of the, what we used to call captains of industry. Now we'd call them captains of finance. I mean, to put a number on it, Diane, in 2004, there was a ranking of the 25 largest hedge fund managers in the United States, and 10 of them lived or worked in one town. And the effect was extraordinary because in the previous year, they had made, on average, $207 million in 1 year. And so there was this really kind of dramatic, almost stratospheric accumulation of wealth in one place. And I wanted to understand what it did to the place as a result of that.
And what about West Virginia?
West Virginia was the first place I worked out of college. I got a job at a scrappy newspaper called the Clarksburg Exponent Telegram in the city of Clarksburg, West Virginia, population 16,000. And I was a photographer at this little paper, and not a particularly good one, I should add, but they were very generous, though I probably got the message I should look at writing instead. But it was an extraordinary place to learn to be a journalist, partly because a local newspaper in a community of that size plays an enormously important role. It's not just the place where they report the sports scores and the, you know, menu at the high school. It's also the place where they contend with who they want to be as a culture. And there was a wonderful observation. Arthur Miller, the playwright, once said that a newspaper is a nation talking to itself. And that's true on the community level too. And just briefly, I'll mention one example, which is that after 9/11, the Exponent Telegram published an editorial in the paper, and it said in its kind of humble way, it said, "Far be it for a small town newspaper to tell the country how to behave. But our hope, our belief, our conviction is that this attack must make us recommit ourselves to the values we hold dear, values of diversity and values of freedom of thought and opinion." And in some ways, there's something poignant about going back and looking at that.
And in some ways, we went exactly in the opposite way.
Absolutely. And when you go through the newspapers of that time, you see, in a sense, how we hoped we might respond as a country. And when you put that juxtaposed against the record of the last 20 years, it can be a harsh thing to see, but I think a very productive thing to look at where we made choices.
And why Chicago?
I worked at the Chicago Tribune for 9 years, and it's where my family is originally from. But more importantly, it's also the place in America that has been, for a century, in some ways, our most perfect laboratory for the study of the city. I mean, it has been described as the great American city because, as Frederick Jackson Turner put it at the beginning of the 20th century, it's the place in the nation where all the forces intersect. And that's true both for good and for bad. I mean, today, to give you an example, Chicago is, by some measures, the most segregated big city in America in terms of racial segregation. It's also a place that contends with the effects and the origins of violence that is concentrated in parts of the city and has just a profound effect on people's lives in ways that I think are easy to miss when we just look at it from afar. So my hope was that by taking these three places, which have such a different vantage point on the experience of being American, that I might be able to put them together in my own mind and fashion something of an idea about what it means to be American at this point in our history.
So do you think the three areas, despite their totally different characteristics, really represent something that tells us together about the U.S. and where it's been and where it's going?
I think that what I was surprised to discover, honestly, Diane, was not that these places are so different and are so divided. That, in a way, we already know that. And it's useful to document it. But the thing that really surprised me was the way in which they are, in fact, affecting one another every day. I mean, I'll give you just one example, which is that in West Virginia, if you talk to people about things like guns, the Second Amendment, West Virginia has a very high level of gun ownership. People there consider it a part of traditional culture. And they kind of react hostily to the idea that that folks in New York or Washington would say that they can't have guns on the scale that they do. And they say, who are we hurting if we take care of our guns? Well, there is a fascinating fact, which is that according to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, West Virginia is one of the states that sends the most guns out of state. It's known as the Iron Pipeline, and they end up in places like Philadelphia and Albany and Chicago. And so when you're trying to understand how Chicago, which is a state with some of the strictest gun laws in the country, is beset by this kind of violence, you have to look at it in the context of how it fits into the country, because what happens in other places doesn't stay in those places. We are interconnected in a way that I think is easy to ignore when it feels as if we are so divided.
You know, it's so interesting because here I am in Washington, D.C., hearing about gun violence every single day, children being shot in their own living and dining rooms, people being robbed and shot on the street. What's happening in Chicago isn't staying in Chicago.
Right.
And those gun exports from West Virginia are going all over the country.
Exactly right. And I was really struck by that, in a sense, what feels like a paradox, where we are this vast country. We are extraordinarily diverse as a place, and that is our strength. And yet, in a way, what has happened is that people over the last 20 years have become more, we've become sort of marooned in our own places in the way that we overlook the degree of interdependence. And part of my project was to try to render us as something of a single portrait, because I kind of want to force us into that awareness of interdependence. And I think part of this, if I'm being honest about it, is that it resonates with me on the kind of philosophical level, which is a belief that we are only going to be able to make this country strong again, or strong in the first place, if we recognize that level of interdependence. And I think we often ignore that.
How much does Donald Trump have to do with the divisions created since 9/11 and leading up to January 6th?
He was an accelerant on the fire and continues to be. And the reason why I use that word is that he is both, in his own way, the origin of things. We know that, certainly. He gave form to a particular realm of ideas which had been thrust off stage, and he brought them onto the main stage of politics and said, it's okay to speak in these terms about immigration or about Mexicans. It's okay to talk about, as we all remember, S-hole countries, and to talk about things in a way that I think as a culture we had decided was not fit for public political life. And yet he was also a symptom of these much deeper ailments in American public life. And that's the part, frankly, that I was most interested in. I got interested in him as a book subject in 2015. It was actually, I remember the day. I mean, I remember the moment when I thought, I think I need to write a book about this, which is the night of the first Republican debate in August of 2015. That night, we sort of remember it. It was a night that he ended up in a kind of confrontation with Megyn Kelly. But actually, what struck me about it was that I watched it at the home of some Trump supporters in Ohio. And one of them, the host, was drinking out of a coffee cup with a swastika on it. He's a white nationalist. And the fact that he was willing to do that in front of a reporter, the fact that he was announcing himself as somebody interested in Donald Trump as a president, I thought to myself, what has happened? How did that happen? And I realized I didn't think he was going to win, but I thought, even if he doesn't come close to winning, I have to understand how this moment became possible.
Did you talk with that man about why he had reached that level of interest in holding a cup with a swastika and supporting Donald Trump?
Look, he is a white nationalist, that guy. He is somebody who believes that he's in a, and this is his description of reality, obviously. He believes he's in an existential battle for the survival of his quote-unquote way of life. And
does that mean a white way?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, he sees himself as imperiled by diversity. He thinks that Black and Latino Americans are seeking to eliminate him as a class of people with power. So he's almost explicit about his sense of the loss of status as being the origin of this. And, you know, I think what's fascinating to me is that a guy like him, there have been Nazis in America for a long time. Let's not have any illusions about that. But what was striking to me was the kind of confidence with which he wanted to announce himself and to say, I'm here and I am, and I'm not going away. And I found that chilling, you know, just completely chilling, because I remember, you know, Diane, I remember when I was working on that piece I was writing a piece for the New Yorker that summer about it, about Donald Trump's candidacy. And I remember I wrote a section about Philip Roth's book, The Plot Against America, which imagines a world in which essentially it's a sort of counterfactual version of American history in which xenophobic America first nationalism prevails with a trace of Nazism. And I remember I wrote that section and I didn't put it into the piece because I thought this feels over the top. Maybe I'm going too far. I'm just overreading it. And in retrospect, of course, no, it can happen here. And we must remind ourselves that it can happen here.
Do you know, I am now doing a monthly book club for WAMU, and that was the second book I chose.
Yeah, wow.
Because I felt it was such an important book. And remain so.
100% agree, yeah.
However, here we have Joe Biden coming into office, and as you say, with the help of people who stood firm against the pressures that Donald Trump was trying to exert, Joe Biden with promises of somehow bringing us back to those principles that we thought as a country we held dear. How successful do you think he's been thus far?
To some degree, there was always going to be a level of frustration because even under better circumstances, politicians will, as you know, campaign in poetry and govern in prose. And this is especially true in this case. As a candidate, he was appealing to some deeper American longing for something more decent than what we had been living through for 4 years. And people responded to it. I mean, I am encouraged by the fact that there was record turnout in 2020. And, you know, newsflash, Joe Biden's not the most thrilling politician for most Americans, particularly young Americans, and yet they turned out in extraordinary numbers to try to usher Donald Trump out of the White House. But if Biden bet on rationality and bet on reason and bet on, you know, what we sometimes kind of gently describe as our better angels, that's not something that's going to change overnight, and certainly hasn't. I would argue, in fact, that it's gotten worse. I mean, we're now 8 months later after inauguration, and the virus and the vaccine have become braided into this set of anxieties and hatreds that are so closely associated with Trumpism. And I would also say, though, Diane, I think it's early days. I mean, I am willing to believe, because I see it around me, and I suspect you've probably sensed some of this too, that there is a degree to which Americans were seared by the experience of just how close to disaster Donald Trump brought this country, that there is some element of a lesson that we can't unlearn. But I worry about it. I worry about it.
Well, with good reason, it seems to me, because he is still making his presence extremely prominent on the national scene. My concern is, and my question, why is the press. Why is the news media covering him in such large degree? He's out of office. He stands for things most Americans do not stand for. So is the press in part responsible for the continuing unraveling, a continuing pushback against things like the COVID virus, things like clean energy? I mean, he's out there, he's talking about these things, and the press and television networks keep covering him.
I do think there is a certain level of commercial addiction to Donald Trump and what he gives to media organizations. He is, let's be blunt, he is an almost indispensable ingredient for some media organizations now. And that pains me because I look at it and I think to myself, well, my industry is part of sustaining him. But there's another piece of it too, which I think that there's a bit of a sense that that he has to be acknowledged simply because there are so many people who still associate themselves with him as voters, and they still exert some political power. We don't know exactly how much, but you know, clearly the Twitter and Facebook and so on made the decision to get him off of their platforms, which was, I think, overdue. But at a certain point, he's found his way back into public life. But if you take as an example, there was this rally on September 18th in Washington, which was a total non-entity. And it was, you know, it was many more reporters than there were actual protesters.
Right.
And I think you could draw from that, you know, for one, clearly people were over-prepared, reporters over-covered it. On the other hand, I think there's a little bit of a lesson that people don't want to be caught flat-footed, because on January 6th, let's be honest, I mean, the press didn't know that was going to be as important and as horrific as it was, you know, Congress, Capitol Police, and so on. And I think there's a little bit of us fighting the last war and not always getting it quite right.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Evan Osnos. We're back. Here is the rest of my conversation with Evan Osnos, staff writer at The New Yorker and author of the book titled Wildland, The Making of America's Fury. Evan, what about politicians such as Mitch McConnell, Ted Cruz, the leader of House Republicans? I mean, it goes on, the effort to divide from the highest ranking politicians.
I totally agree with you. I mean, one of the things I try to do in this book is to broaden the focus beyond just Donald Trump, to say you have to look at people like Mitch McConnell, Kevin McCarthy, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, because what we're really talking about is an entire cohort of people who serve in Americans' name and are doing terrible violence to our political values. You can't shy away from that. And I think in a way, it's actually misleading for us to say it started with Trump and he's the primary and the sole malevolent agent. No, actually, he is part of a broader culture of disregard for American political values of any decent kind. And I am part of the thing that I return to is the sense that personal ambition, just this kind of throbbing thermonuclear ambition you see from some members of Republican leadership that we were just talking about, has a way of crowding out anything else that matters. And I find that to be a worrying fact, and it's one that I try to highlight as often as I can.
Evan, how important has Black Lives Matter and the murder of George Floyd and other incidents involving police, how important have those been in strengthening the opposition to what's really a multicultural America.
Yeah, you know, in a way, the Donald Trump movement, to use a shorthand for a broader phenomenon, you know, they have seized on the events of the last year, the protests against racial injustice, and have enlisted that in their own marketing. And I use that word by choice, because in a way, it satisfies a lot of the narratives that they've been using for a long time, which is the idea that that we are unsafe in a more diverse country, and that we are facing unreasonable demands for justice. And I think, you know, that has become part of the narrative. I heard it on January 6th. I was there as a reporter for The New Yorker, and I was talking to people who were standing at the foot of the Capitol. And I tell some of this in Wildland, that I was struck by how many of them were operating in an entirely hermetic universe of information, in which Antifa was a vast and terrifying force that was threatening to undo everything that you believe to be true in this country. And you could hear in those descriptions of Black Lives Matter that they regarded this as a satisfying enemy. You know, this was something that provided meaning to them, because otherwise, you know, this sort of slightly incoherent collection of political actors who were there on January 6th, they didn't have a target. And in a sense, Black Lives Matter and Antifa had become enemy number one for them.
And politicians. I mean, they went after Nancy Pelosi. They went after the vice president of the United States.
Yeah.
I mean, it was so shocking in its, not only its dimensions, but also in its targeting.
And that, for me, Diane, was the real discovery, the moment of awareness, was that they were fundamentally hostile to the American political establishment in a profound way. I mean, you know, the number of people who I met that day, Diane, who said this was their first trip to Washington, D.C., you know, it was as if they were storming a foreign capital. And that was a sign to me of just how alienated and really sort of removed they were from American politics. And that is a sign of the ways in which all of these things that had been accumulating in the years leading up to it, some of them related to Donald Trump, but some of them before. As an example, I tell some stories of people, of cases of public corruption. For instance, the governor of Virginia, Bob McDonnell, who was convicted for receiving hundreds of thousands of dollars in gifts from a political patron. The Supreme Court later overturned that ruling. And legal scholars will tell you that did terrible damage to the ability to hold corrupt officials accountable. The reason I mention all that is that in a kind of subtle way, all of these cases of self-enrichment or vanity or sheer naked ambition of the kind that Ted Cruz exhibited when he shut down the government in 2013, these examples were just trickling into the political groundwater for years, and gradually turning people off to the idea that the government was something that was able to help them in their lives. And it took on a particularly poisonous form in the events of January 6th.
How much of the thinking that went into January 6th continues to permeate throughout the country and will rise and rise and rise again?
I'm afraid that it is going to be a fact of our lives for another two decades. And the reason why I don't say this just on my own account. I mean, in November of 2020, so shortly before the election, it might have been in October, I published a piece in The New Yorker about what we called the violent style, meaning the idea that violence had become an entity in elite politics in a way that really had been off stage for a long time. We haven't seen moments like this for a long time. And, you know, there have been patterns of violence throughout American political history. But we're right now, and this was a couple of months before January 6th, but right now we are in this moment of a contest between the power of reason and the power of force. And you saw that in the run-up to the election, where, remember, there was this plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan, and you had these ways in which the vocabulary, the visual vocabulary of force, wearing a gun and carrying a gun in public, all of that was becoming much more prominent. And the scholars who study violent attitudes in politics, not just in the United States, but globally, they tell you that the alarm bells are ringing. And, you know, Larry Diamond, who, for instance, at Stanford, says that he worries that this kind of casual permission to talk about violence or revolution to, you know, you remember, it goes back to Sarah Palin, for instance, who said, we don't retreat, we reload. And all of this kind of valorizing of revolutionary rhetoric going back to the Tea Party, that plays an accumulating effect on people's minds that gives them the sense that this is, in fact, an activity that is just on this side of violence. And I think there's a temptation sometimes to look at these people who show up on January 6th dressed as Minutemen from the revolution and think, well, is this a kind of role-playing game, a sort of costume? But actually, no. I mean, I spend time going to gun shows for political reporting in order to understand the role that these two cultures play. And there is a way in which they've become intertwined in a very world.
How do you do that when you go to a gun show? I mean, what do you do? How do you approach people? What do you ask?
Well, I'm very upfront about it. I actually try to make a point of carrying my notebook, carrying my recorder, and telling people I'm a reporter from The New Yorker, or I'm an author working on a book about violence in American life or politics. I realized long ago that actually, in a curious way, it's safer to be very upfront about it, because then people don't feel as if you're hiding something, and they'll decide whether to talk to you. And you do get a lot of no's. People say, I don't want to talk to your liberal media stooge or something like that. But other people, you'd be amazed how many want to talk to you, because as I've often concluded, some of them are desperate for somebody to listen to them. And, you know, their ideas can be bizarre and offensive, but it's interesting to hear what they have to say, because otherwise we don't know what's going on in subcultures that end up having a big impact and a scary impact in this country.
What are they telling you?
I hear from people a kind of terrified existential conflict. They say that they feel as if they are on the losing end of a battle for their own existence, specifically against a more diverse country. They talk about, you know, a number of them say that they imagine that in the future, as they said to me, and I've quoted some of them sparingly, because I think sparingly is the way to do it. You don't, in a sense, you don't want to give undue attention to ideas that are, you need to establish that they exist so we understand what the real political landscape is, but you don't want to give people oxygen who are just doing this for the sake of getting attention. That's kind of a key distinction, I think. But one of the things that you will hear is that they'll say that they think in the future they will be a hated minority, and that they fear for their children. And that kind of idea is something that Donald Trump harvested. And he figured out that, you know, as one of his political mentors, Roger Stone, once said, quoting, you know, Roy Cohn, if you go back in the lineage, that you can attract more people with fear and hate than you can with love. And part of what we're living through in this period, and what I've tried to document, is that this is a period in which those ideas have surged to the fore. And in effect, some of the most powerful political players in the country are using that day to day.
Are you frightened?
I am, because I see how this is not going to go away anytime soon. And yet, I have to say, I'm also encouraged. And this is not just a sort of blandly cheerful, everything's going to be fine. By no means do I think that's the case. What I mean is that I see the way in which you have large numbers of Americans, across the racial spectrum, across class, who are saying, no, this is not a country that I am going to allow to be pulled into the hands of a hateful politics. I simply won't allow it. And you saw this in the scale of the protests around Black Lives Matter, in which you saw people from all walks of life joining a movement that, frankly, I don't think they would have joined even 4 or 5 years earlier. They would have said, that's not for me. And I think people, partly as a result of the Trump years, came to recognize that that these issues actually are, that they apply broadly across the full range of our political lives. And that if you don't care about injustice in one place, then ultimately you're not standing up for justice at the most fundamental level.
It seems to me what you're talking about is continued civil clashes that will be ongoing perhaps for the next 2 decades, but you're not, I hope, talking about an all-out civil war.
No, I'm not. And I don't see that happening. I am actually more impressed by the power of civil action, of people actually taking a role through the instruments of politics. I mean, this is the thing that strikes me as meaningful, is that if you look at the way people are talking about making real reforms to government today, about expanding the social safety net, about attending to these fundamental failures of government provision that have been allowed to go on for 30 or 40 years. You know, the fact that we don't have healthcare or early child education on a par with other industrialized countries, things like that, which are now really at the center of our politics. I mean, you and I are talking at a time when the Congress is about to make some of these really crucial distinctions, choices about what we're going to do. But that is all actually, in its own way, a response to, I think, some of the horrors of the Trump years. It has forced people to recognize that politics matter, and that if we don't take an interest in it ourselves, then others will govern in our names. And I, you know, at one point I remember, I think it was Elihu Root who said, you know, he said, people will govern or they will be governed. And I was really struck by the way in which the experience of having lived under Donald Trump for 4 years has brought people who are horrified by him to an awareness that we simply have to participate. Participation is the bottom line. I mean, I come to this partly having moved back to the United States, and I took note of a startling fact, which was that in West Virginia in 1960, 75% of eligible voters voted in the presidential election. It was higher, 12 points or so higher than the national average. And when I came back to the United States in the most recent presidential election, 2012, voter turnout had dropped to 46%, second lowest in the country. And I was just amazed by that. And that was in its own way a quiet register of despair. And I said, that's the seam right there that I have to really begin to try to understand.
You're talking about all these bills that are up on the Hill. There is so much political clashing going on, maneuvering going on. Are we going to see progress in these next 4 years, 3.5, do you believe?
I do. It may not be as expansive as the most maximalist position in the Democratic Party, but there will be real legislation. It's a fact. And right now, they are in the teeth of those kind. That is lawmaking. I mean, they are having these sorts of close quarters, smiling through gritted teeth kinds of negotiations among Democrats. But already, I mean, if you just took the stimulus bill that passed back in March, that in itself constituted a substantial expansion of things like the child tax credit, which is even beyond the technical value of it, which provides an important source of support, particularly to vulnerable families. It's also a reframing of what we expect and imagine of government. And I think that's important because we're at the end of a period in which there has been this sort of the assumption for a long time, to quote Ronald Reagan, was that government is not here to help you. And I think you see that we're going through a period, particularly after the pandemic, in which people realize, no, actually, there are some things that if you want to be a country that is successful, you want to be competitive, you want to be able to keep pace with other industrialized nations, that we have to recognize that there are things we can do to ensure people can enter the workforce and make sure that they're educated, make sure that we can make up for these kinds of radical differences in income and wealth by providing a basic level of support and education at the early years. These kinds of things have gone from being radical ideas to being, okay, now we're fighting about the details and the size. And that's progress. So, you know, it's funny to me, I think, Diane, because Joe Biden was not somebody who people would have said 20 years ago, this is a guy who is going to punch through the crust of American political history and try to change not just specific bills, but also how we actually think about the role of the state. And in a way, it's because people didn't expect that of him, I think, that it's more possible that because he's coming from a moderate tradition, because he's in a way, you could say, if Joe Biden thinks that we need these kinds of reforms, well, then you know the situation is really desperate.
Evan Osnos, thank you.
Thanks, Diane. That was fun.
That was Evan Osnos, author of Wildland, The Making of America's Fury. Evan is a staff writer at The New Yorker, a CNN contributor, and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Bruntberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody, with help from Sandra Baker. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.